Edward Warson is University Professor of History and holds the Hugh and Hazel Darling Chair in Law at Pepperdine University. He's also an inaugural library fellow at the Fred Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington in Mount Vernon, Virginia. His new book is The Return of George Washington, 1783 to 1789. Warson, a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, looks at why George Washington returned to the spotlight. Again, the title of the book is The Return of George Washington, 1783 to 1789. And it's a pleasure to welcome Edward Warson to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you with us. What brought you to this particular span of time, these 6 years, and looking at the return of George Washington?
I'm a history professor, and for years I've taught American history. And when you teach American history, if you follow the conventional pattern, you spend a few days on the Revolutionary War, and Washington's all over the place, of course, he's the commander-in-chief. Then you spend a couple of days talking about the Confederation government and the collapse of the Confederation, how everything's falling apart, which was especially true in New England, especially with Vermont conspiring to go off to Canada and Massachusetts having Shays Rebellion, Rhode Island, printing paper money, threatening private property rights in New York, taxing its neighbors and funding itself with that and dividing the states apart. And you don't hear anything about Washington. And then you get to the presidency, and it's all about Washington again. All you know is Washington went off back to his plantation and was a farmer. And you're sitting there, and as I was teaching this over the years, I kept wondering, now, really? Washington was the most famous person in the world, probably, the celebrity in America. He'd fought 9 years without leave or pay, leading the revolution. He'd led his soldiers, who he dearly respected and loved, were dying. He just went back to Mount Vernon and farmed while everything was collapsing around him. And so I decided to really focus and find out what was Washington really doing during that period. Well, he was farming. I found out he was farming. He was a very innovative farmer, restoring his plantation to prosperity. He tried to go out to his frontier holdings in the Ohio Valley in really a remarkable trip. But he was also, because of what he saw was happening around him, because he saw the threats to individual liberty, to private property rights, to even independence, he was increasingly involved, the glue that was trying to knit the country together into a more perfect union that led first to the Constitution and then to him becoming president. His political involvement, the one time in his life where he, or key time in his life when he didn't have official power, how he used it, what he did, that's what led me into the story. I ended up getting a fellowship from Mount Vernon to spend time living right in Washington's, on his estate, so I could walk around there anytime before the tourists came or after they left, worked on his papers, trying to figure out exactly what Washington was doing.
At what point do you think he realized that things were in disarray, that when he was at Mount Vernon, that things were not as he expected them to be or wanted them to be?
Well, he actually realized it before he stepped down, while he was still a general. He wrote a circular letter to the states, to all the governors, while he was still commander-in-chief. He said, I'm retiring soon. Here are the problems. His troops hadn't been paid for 2 years. The army was collapsing. The states were beginning to go their separate ways. When you think about it, if you're, each state is totally sovereign, led by local politicians with local interests, how are they going to expand? Well, they're going to expand at the expense of their neighbor being, if they were New York, extend at the expense of Connecticut and New Jersey. You were seeing that happen. He saw it happen. There was no common currency. So he worried about that, and he wrote this plea that became famous. It was read throughout the country. In fact, during those Confederation years, it was generally regarded as the second most famous document in America, second to the Declaration of Independence, typically read at 4th of July ceremonies. But then, as he went back home, he hoped for the best. He really thought his role was over. He wanted to go back to his plantation. He loved farming. He was a hands-on manager of his farm. But then, day by day, letter by letter, he saw it getting worse. He had many correspondents in Massachusetts and New England, such as the governor of Connecticut was a very close friend, Henry Knox from Boston. Of course, many people in New York, like John Jay, were in regular correspondence with him. The governor of New Hampshire, John Langdon, was a very close friend from the Revolutionary days. They were sending him letters telling him what was happening. And he actually, from Henry Knox, who was Secretary of War under the Confederation, and from Boston, he got a very, very disappointing and dreadful and fear-inspiring account of what was happening in Massachusetts with what was later called Shays' Rebellion. And those things, they just built. And so finally he sent a letter to his most trusted colleagues, like including Henry Knox in Massachusetts and John Jay in New York, asking for their ideas of what was needed for a new confederation. He did that in 1786. He got their feedback, sort of compiled together in his own handwriting into what would become sort of the first form of what would become the Constitution. Those were the steps, and they led him in. And New England, actually, especially events in Massachusetts and Rhode Island were central to the process.
I was curious in reading the book of how much you felt that he had a reluctance to get more involved.
It was a combination of things. He was torn two ways. He truly wanted to step down. He'd been 9 years leading the troops. His economic future lied on his plantation and his frontier lands. He enjoyed farming. He wanted to go home. He really hoped that somebody else would step forward. But on the other hand, he also had he would call it providence, a great sense of providence, of purpose. He thought that purpose originally was served by his service during the Revolutionary War, which made him the most famous person in the world, and along with Ben Franklin, the most beloved person in all of the colonies from Georgia to New Hampshire. And he felt a sense of calling and a sense of purpose. And when he became convinced by so many of others, people he respected, that only he could serve as the glue. Ben Franklin by then was too old, serve as the glue to pull the country back together. And the people trusted him because he, remember, these were people who had experienced the troubles of the Revolution and the problems of King George and the British rule. They trusted him with power because they knew he didn't want it. They knew he was willing to give it up after the Revolution when he could have stayed on, like most rebel leaders, and become a king or a ruler. He had stepped down, so they trusted him with power, realized that he was the glue that could hold it together. He was very concerned with his legacy. He wanted to make a difference, and he truly believed in the Republican ideal, to have a government, as he always called it, a government of the people rather than of the few. That is, not a monarchy, not an aristocracy, but some sort of a Republican form of government. That was a new experiment at the time. He was committed to it, and he just gradually became convinced that that was his calling, that was his duty, and he always did his duty.
You address this in the book, but he was receiving pressure from Franklin and Madison and Hamilton and the other founding fathers.
They told him that it couldn't work without him. Whether it was Ben Franklin or Alexander Hamilton or Gouverneur Morris or Robert Morris, Henry Knox from Massachusetts, they were all saying, you're the only one. It can only work if you come out. And so they did put quite a bit of pressure on him to come to the Constitutional Convention. He was especially reluctant to do that, but when he became convinced that the Constitutional Convention might work, that it was willing to try, as he called it, radical ideas, to try to form a new government, a national government of some sort, they finally pressured him and persuaded him that it would not work without him. Then the same thing happened for the presidency, but honestly, I think that once he agreed to go to Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention, once it was clear it was going to be ratified, by this time, he recognized the inevitable, that he would be drafted. So it was less of a drafting. Certainly, he did not campaign for the office,
right.
Didn't actively seek it, but he knew it was inevitable by then.
It's hard to read this story, knowing what we know now, and many of us having some political cynicism, of reading this and not thinking that he's basically coming to Philadelphia to craft a job that he wants. But that's really not the case.
I don't think it was a job he wanted. He was he wasn't coming to craft it, but of course everybody there knew it was a job he would get, or at least most people thought that. certainly that was what all the newspapers were saying, that inevitably the only reason, or at least people then were confident, the only reason the Constitution was ratified because, and especially with such a strong presidency, that it was because Washington was going to hold the job, and they trusted him with that power. So I don't think he was certainly going for that reason. He was good with others. He was not the wax figure that we tend to imagine. He wasn't like sort of like that terrible picture on the $1 bill of him with the bulging cheeks because of his false teeth. I mean, he looked so formidable. He actually was a tremendous people person, and being able to write about him during this period when he didn't have formal power, you can really see it. He was a great retail politician. He got along well with others. He trusted others. He listened. He was great at working compromise. He did that during the Revolution when the victory was doubtful. He always, before battle, had a meeting with all of his aides, including younger ones. He would listen to those younger ones. He had a great sense of confidence in himself, but he knew he didn't know everything. And so he'd listen, think about things. It's the way he operated as president. It's certainly the way he operated during this period. So he wasn't really, I do not believe, thinking about himself. He was trying to think about a government that could work, that could be pulled together and cobbled together in this very, very dangerous situation, and that would work. Now, he always realized, I don't try to, you know, hide warts in this book, he always realized people were motivated by self-interest. But he thought that if he could create a stronger union, it would preserve political independence, which was in danger with the British and with the Spanish, but it could also promote individual liberty, which he was committed to, and protect property rights, which he was concerned about, and promote prosperity. He thought with a national market economy, breaking down the divisions, back then each state could print its own money, it have tariffs against goods from other states. There was no fluid economy. He thought, of course, that would help him, but it would help everyone. It would allow America to grow the pie for everyone and not limit it to each state fighting against each other and nobody looking out for the frontier where he had property. So he realized it's a combination of, I think I know what's best for the country. I've listened to a lot of others. How can I convince others of that so that we all grow together?
The name of the book is The Return of George Washington, 1783 to 1789. Edward Larson has been our guest. He's the author of the book, and it is published by William Morrow. Edward Larson, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Return of George Washington, 1783 to 1789. Edward Larson is the author, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for History. The book is published by Morrow. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.